This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Law and Behold, of course, is our ongoing series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. The series has been running since 2018, and we've got about 34 episodes in the bag since we started. So today we're revisiting previous episodes of the series from 2020 specifically, which covered some of the major events that shaped the year that was. So first up, we're going to revisit an episode from May, where we addressed the arrests of undocumented migrants across Kuala Lumpur in a bid to curb the spread of COVID-19. At that time, also, Malaysian authorities had turned away hundreds of Rohingya refugees stranded at sea. So in the federal constitution, the right to life and the right to equal treatment is guaranteed to all persons without distinguishing the citizenship status of the person. So this includes the right to humane treatment and to dignity of life. So in the snippet that you're about to hear, Firdaus Husni and Surendra Anand share their views on the actions of the authorities and whether it was indeed a violation of human rights.
There's a few angles that we can talk about when we look at the mass arrests by the government. One, from the point of effectively addressing the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, I don't see how any of the action, how any of the arrests is helping to address that, because due to the nature of COVID-19 itself, it is important to ensure that everyone, not just Malaysians, non-Malaysians, have the right to healthcare. So, that is one of the biggest concerns that civil societies have also raised. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what has been happening, it's not that only this month or this year that we see that we have undocumented migrants in Malaysia. And for some reason, this time around, you can sense that there's a rise in xenophobia. Mm. If you look at social media, and that's very concerning. It's not just discrimination or stereotyping. There are even calls to end the lives of these undocumented migrants, and that's something that's very worrying and very scary to note indeed.
Yeah, just to quickly add on. I'm sure that we will go into international law at some point later in the show, but just looking at it from a domestic human rights perspective, a lot of people forgot that, or tend to forget that, the right to life and the right to equal treatment are guaranteed under the Constitution. And most importantly, it's guaranteed to all persons. Mm. Well, some other rights like free speech is given only to citizens. So the right to life and the right to equal treatment are afforded to all persons, and the Constitution does not distinguish as to the status of that person. So while you might be undocumented, regardless of your status, you're still entitled to the right to life, which includes the right to humane treatment and also to dignity of life. So I think that's an aspect which we need to remember, that our Constitution actually guarantees these certain rights, regardless of your status in the country. And that's not even going to international law yet, of course.
Mm, but you know, Defence Minister Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri, he said that Malaysia is just following the laws of this country, you know, that even though the migrants were living under lockdown, their presence is still illegal. And therefore, you know, I remember yesterday in his press briefing, he said that, you know, all countries across the world, they are doing this, you know, that is their right to clamp down on undocumented and illegal migrants in Malaysia.
That has been, to me, that has been their fallback argument every time questions or a backlash was raised as to the treatment of undocumented migrants in the country. And to me, that does not take into account that even our own constitution, just like what Suren said earlier, make a mention in certain provisions like the right to life, like the right to equality and equal protection of the law, it does not say only citizens. It says no persons shall be denied their right to life, and all persons are entitled to equal protection. So I do not think that statement by the minister takes into account that there's a reason why these particular provisions are as such, while other provisions are not.
That's right. And, you know, it goes against everything that he announced back on the 22nd of March, you know, when the government said that they agreed to neither look into the legal status of foreigners nor take any action against them for being in the country illegally, you know, when they came forward for COVID-19 screenings. Am I correct?
Yes. When that assurance was first given, it was clear and it was transparent. And I think we can all agree that was premised on the concern to effectively address and contain COVID-19. And so exactly on that concern and premise, there shouldn't be a U-turn in the approach by the government. But that is what we are seeing today. And I don't know which goes first, whether it was propelled by these xenophobic sentiments on social media or the other way around. But either way, it's definitely a change or a reversal in the approach, which was correct the first time around.
That's right. I mean, because, you know, when you resort to these sort of mass arrests, you know, that will invariably create a culture of fear that will just ripple out amongst the migrant communities and, I guess, you know, completely scare them away from coming forward to be tested at all if, you know, they manage to escape being arrested.
Yeah. And then even if you look at this from a pure nationalist point of view, I just don't see how it benefits anyone. If you're only looking at addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, then detaining people and putting them in detention centers, that's quite the opposite than to address the COVID-19 scenario. So whichever angle they look at this, I just don't see how one can justify the most recent actions by the government.
So, you know, for those who have been arrested or detained, you know, do they have legal rights here in Malaysia if you know, they are being placed in detention centers?
So there are laws, domestic laws, which addresses how they should be treated. These are largely under the Immigration Act. That's one. And if they are, for example, a victim of trafficking or smuggling, we have the Anti-Trafficking in Persons and Anti-Smuggling of Migrants Act. And a couple of other domestic acts, depending on the situations they are in. For example, if they have been exploited by their employers, then there is the Employment Act, there's the Workmen's Compensation Act. The trouble here is that the government, a couple of years ago, set up what is called the National Legal Aid Foundation, but this legal aid does not extend to non-Malaysian. And so they are cut off from, you know, from accessing that as an avenue to help them to access this legal recourse.
Because, you know, like you said, like, even though the avenues for legal redress are available, I mean, what would the sort of indigent state of the many migrants, you know, it's quite likely to place them in a situation where they can't actually seek legal action, right?
Yes, that's right. Because the way that they are treated in the country, that in itself, it's not does not provide a conducive environment for them to seek justice in a situation where they are. They are, you know, in a predicament not by their own volition. For example, they paid a lot of money thinking that they will be here on a legitimate visa, they'll be given legitimate work, only to find out that when they're here, there's no such thing as a legitimate visa, no work at all, and, you know, they've been left with nothing, and they have nothing that they can, you know, that can help them to go back. So in that situation, where would they go? And if they were to go to the authorities, it's going to be them who's facing the system, not the person who put them in that predicament in the first place. So that is definitely something that, you know, that should be improved within our system and within how we treat them.
So are there any sort of action-oriented policies, practices or strategies that are in place to sort of prevent human rights violations and abuses against non-documented migrants here in Malaysia?
I think in Malaysia, I mean, Firdaus can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be more of a knee-jerk reaction sort of scenario here. We don't have any comprehensive plan on how to address this situation on asylum seekers and refugees. So an example of a knee-jerk reaction was that I think the AG's chambers, the Attorney General chambers, did come up with a policy not to charge persons who have UNHCR cards for being here illegally, for example. But besides that, I can't really think of any concrete policies. And the only reason typically given by the government is that they are not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. But I think many forget that the Refugee Convention is not the only convention that governs how a country should be treating asylum seekers and refugees. That convention was drafted way back in 1951, where there was no human rights conventions in place at that time. But since 1951, you had a whole number of human rights conventions, which include the Convention Against Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of Children, and the Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons, all of which Malaysia has signed and ratified, which includes, through its jurisprudence, the obligation of non-refoulement, which is obligation not to send persons back to a place where they can be tortured, and also the obligation to treat these categories of persons humanely and provide them with certain fundamental rights. So just because Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, that does not mean they are not obligated under international law to come up with a proper framework to address the scenario on asylum seekers and refugees. That obligation is still there under international law. So something needs to be done, and it has to be comprehensive, or else, you know, like Firdaus said, they're going to be left in this continuous scenario where they will always be oppressed, afraid, in this very non-conducive environment. And until that is addressed, I don't think anyone is going to benefit, neither the state, nor the refugees or asylum seekers.
You just heard Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and Surendra Ananth, a constitutional lawyer, discussing the rights of undocumented migrants during this pandemic here in Malaysia. So to hear that interview in full, just search for Law and Behold, Episode 22, Rights of Undocumented Migrants in the Time of COVID-19. You can search for that at bfm.my or on the BFM app. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, more snippets from Law and Behold episodes from the year past. You're tuned to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Lo and Behold on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacob. So on today's show, we are looking back at some previous episodes from the series, which took on major current events that happened here in Malaysia in 2020. So in this next snippet that you're about to hear, we discuss the conviction of former Prime Minister Dato' Sri Najib Tun Razak, who was sentenced by the High Court to 12 years jail and fined 210 million ringgit after he was found guilty of all seven charges related to the misappropriation of 42 million ringgit of SRC international funds. So in this episode, we discuss the former Premier's rights to a fair trial appeal and his position as an MP following his conviction. And we did this with Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. So in this clip that you're about to hear, Prof. Shad helps to clarify what's stated in Article 48(1)(e) of the Federal Constitution, which states that MPs are disqualified if convicted of an offence and sentenced to a jail term of more than a year and fined more than 2,000 ringgit, and if they have not received a free pardon. So what does all of this mean? And does a conviction in the High Court disqualify an MP if he appeals? Here's Prof. Shad explaining.
No, the law as it stands, and I'll say a little bit about how I think the law is in need of amendment. The law as it stands is that if a person is convicted, sentenced to imprisonment for 1 year or more, or fined 2,000 ringgit or more, then if he appeals, appeal definitely operates as a stay of any disqualification, mm-hmm. as long as he's appealing. And even if he loses the appeal, the conviction is upheld, he still has another alternative, and that is to apply for pardon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And while the pardon application is pending, he's still an MP. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes pardon application take a long time. So he's an MP while the appeal is pending, he's an MP. Or within 14 days, he must, of course, apply for pardon if he's still convicted. While the pardon application has not been disposed of, he's still an MP. So the law in this respect actually is rather unusual. A person in a public office with a public trust is found guilty of a heinous criminal offense, and yet actually he continues to remain as an MP. If you look at the law as a whole, you notice bankrupts under 48 clause 1 sub clause B. In bankruptcy, there is no necessary criminal intention. A person may become a bankrupt because of COVID-19, his business collapsed. Mm-hmm. But if he's a bankrupt, well then, unless he discharges his bankruptcy, he loses his seat. If an MP fails to lodge his election return, that disqualifies him from being, and he's convicted of that offense and jailed for 1 year or more, he loses his seat. So the point I'm trying to make is this, that for minor, non-serious, non-heinous offenses, a person can lose his seat. Mm. But in a case like that, the law says that as long as you're appealing or you have not been pardoned, you can continue in your office. And if an MP resigns from his seat, Article 48, Clause 6 says he cannot contest for Parliament for the next few years. So the law actually is a little bit unfair in the sense that it creates the bad impression. Wakil Rayat has been found guilty by a court. Then I think he should be required to pay the price, mm-hmm. rather than still continue to be a member of our August Assembly of Parliament. So that's the way the law is.
Anything you wanted to add to that, Fridawas?
Well, yes. When you look at Article 48, if you know any of the listeners want to know more, Article 48 actually sets out, you know, the whole procedures. There was also some questions on whether or not that matter on disqualification should be a matter decided by the parliament. No, because when it is a conviction by court falling under 48(1)(e), mm-hmm. then no, that should is not a matter for deliberation of parliament at all. And I do see a point that Prof made earlier. You're talking about the August House. You're talking about lawmakers, people making law. And this is one of the most important agency of the government. And so there is, certain standard that we must uphold when you talk about the lawmakers representing the interests of the nation. Mm-hmm. So to me, Article 48, yes, as it stands, that's how it is. He is not disqualified as an MP. Mm-hmm. But if you are talking about the next election, now that's a separate question.
Okay, and that was my next question. You know, what does this mean, you know, for his eligibility to contest in future elections?
His disqualification is immediate, mm-hmm. In the sense that upon his conviction, then he is disqualified from running also the 5 years period.
5 years actually after he has served his sentence.
Yes.
After the 12 years.
From the date of his release of that 12 years, mm-hmm. 5 years after that, then only he can run for the next election. So if let's say if we were to relate this to the situation with Anwar, mm-hmm. That was why even after his release, he missed one or two general election before he can actually run.
Yeah, may I just add to that? There is also the element of pardon. Even if Dato' Najib's conviction is not overturned, he could still apply for a pardon. Mm-hmm. And in the light of the fact that he was the former prime minister, we never know. But maybe the wisdom of the Pardons Board mm-hmm. and of the Yang di Pertuan Agong.
And assuming an MP loses his appeal at the federal court, would he be automatically disqualified?
14 days after he, unless he has secured a pardon.
Okay, unless the pardon. So he's lost his appeal. He didn't get a pardon. Then only he would be disqualified.
Yeah, 14 days, I think. 14 days. 14 days.
Okay, all right. So, and I think, you know, another question on a lot of people's mind is whether this conviction will stick, you know, if Dato' Sri Najib's political future is over. Do you think he could receive a royal pardon should his appeal fail?
Actually, that's very speculative because I think their majesties definitely have the power to pardon. But nevertheless, I'm sure they'll take into consideration the seriousness of the charges that are coming out. And please do bear this in mind that what we have seen in the SRC case is just one case.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few others pending.
That's right.
The total amount involved is huge. And there are allegations of tampering with the Auditor General's report. And there are many other such charges. So this is a nightmare both for him and his family, and in some respects for our nation's reputation. We will continue to be hounded with this reputation of being a kleptocratic nation for a very long time to come.
That's right. And, you know, that is something else I wanted to ask you. You know, what are the implications, both positive and negative, you know, for the nation, you know, of this verdict?
Okay, now that's, before I talk about that, let me just mention this to you, Juliet, that today all three of us here are not here to step on a fallen figure, isn't it?
No.
We are here to reflect on our system of justice as it worked in this infamous SRC case. And more optimistically, we are here to learn from the horrendous disclosures of this case and to see what can be done or should be done to heal our broken system. But that would have to be done at some other future session. But right away, the implications very quickly would be this. I think for the judiciary, this verdict pronounced by the learned judge paints the judiciary in a favorable light. Justice Muhammad Mazlan Ghazali represents the face of a rejuvenated judiciary strengthened by the leadership of Tan Sri Richard Malanjon and now Tan Sri Tengku Maimoon. So I think it's good for the judiciary that the judiciary can resist all the political pressures, the demonstrations outside, which itself, in my personal view, almost amounts to contempt by those who are organizing it, trying to pressurize the judiciary. However, on the sad side, on the negative side, this whole sad case indicates that we have a lot of systems that have broken down. Our parliament is supposed to be the grand inquest of the nation. It is supposed to keep the executive answerable, accountable, responsible. Obviously, it failed to do so. Even the parliament's public accounts committee was totally ineffective. Most of its members were recruited into the executive branch, and therefore the Public Accounts Committee totally collapsed. It was unable to function. What is very, very sad indeed is that people's funds, like in KWAP, were being employed for purposes other than taking care of the retirees. People today will now wonder whether Petronas or EPF or Tabung Haji or Felda or Mara or MOF Incorporated, whether these can be trusted to safeguard the nation's purse. A very, very shocking and sad realization is this, that for our elections, foreign countries can give us massive funds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very funny. When it comes to you and I contesting, there are ceilings beyond which we cannot spend money. Oh, but the ruling party can receive supposedly 42 million or more ringgit from a foreign head of state. Now, how does this affect the integrity of our electoral process? How does this affect our foreign policy? It is perhaps a coincidence that Malaysia sent its forces, armed forces, to take part in the genocidal and fratricidal war in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is actually Saudi Arabia is involved in that war, and the donation came from Saudi Arabia, supposedly, and we are sending our soldiers there. So all these implications for our nation are frightening. But I just hope that there is now only one way to move, and that is to go up. We have fallen so low. We have fallen so low in all these areas. We have institutions that have broken down. I hope the only way now is to go up. And I do hope and pray that the present government, despite all its other political challenges, I hope it can keep the agenda for reform still in line.
That was Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Firdaus Husni, the chief human rights strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, discussing the conviction of Dato' Sri Najib Razak, who was sentenced by the High Court to 12 years jail and fined 210 million ringgit after he was found guilty of all seven charges related to the misappropriation of 42 million ringgit of SRC International Funds. So if you'd like to hear that interview in full, do head to bfm.my and search for the podcast titled Law and Behold, Episode 28, Najib Razak's Rights Post-Conviction. So next up, we're going to look at Malaysia's Supply Bill 2021, which passed its third reading in the lower house with a division vote just on Tuesday, the 15th of December. So in an episode of Law and Behold from the 27th of November, we kind of did a 101 on the budget, how it's tabled, the approval and legislative process. But we also discussed hypothetical situations that could have played out should the budget have been rejected. So here are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi and lawyer New Sin Yu walking us through hypothetical situations had the budget been rejected.
Actually, if the budget proposal fails, please allow me just to outline four very significant consequences, though I'll come to the consequences for the PM. Number one, of course, is as Sin Yu pointed out, there are very significant economic or administrative consequences. The government has no money to spend, to withdraw from the consolidated fund, and that's very serious indeed. However, bear this in mind that the Constitution does provide for a little bit of contingency there. Some items of expenditure like pensions, gratuities, debts, or awards against the government are pre-authorized by the Constitution. However, these amount to only about 20% of the budget. 80% of the expenditure becomes unpayable till authorities obtained from Parliament by the existing or if the government falls by the new government that is appointed. Second very important factor is the Prime Minister's right to govern falls into question. Thirdly, the Yang di-Pertuan Agong is drawn into the vortex of our political happenings, political struggle. Mm-hmm. And actually, he would be faced with a number of very difficult dilemmas, moral, in our case, even medical, economic, political dilemmas, whereby decision one way or the other may be seen as partisan, though actually he was simply struggling to find the best interest of the nation. So he's drawn into the vortex of the political struggle. Fourthly, and this is a long-term thing, if the budget fails, that means there was hopping, crossing the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That means people's faith, citizens' faith in the system, the respect for the MPs weakens more than it is weak right now.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So I think these are the very serious four consequences of the fall of the defeat of a budget. Now, coming to the specific issue as to what will be the effect on the Prime Minister's right to govern. As Sin Yu pointed out earlier, the British Convention is that if the budget fails, the Prime Minister must resign. This is a long-standing British convention. However, I just wanted to point out to your listeners that actually in England on this issue, some change is taking place. In 2011, England passed the Fixed Term Parliament Act 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And now in England, the confidence or no confidence vote must be specifically worded to trigger a general election. So if you want the government to fall, you have to have a vote of no confidence, specifically saying that Her Majesty's, that this House has no confidence in the government of XYZ.
Right.
Secondly, bear this in mind, that even in England, partial defeats on the budget do not result in no confidence. For example, in 1994, the UK government was defeated on VAT for fuel, value-added tax for fuel. So what the Chancellor of Exchequer, the finance minister, did was he just brought new proposals and the government did not resign. So UK also is undergoing some changes, but I'm quite sure that a defeat on the budget will result in a subsequent vote of no confidence in the UK. The Malaysian position is more complicated. Nothing in our constitution explicitly equates a budget defeat with a vote of no confidence. Nothing.
Okay.
However, as we mentioned earlier, Article 43, Clause 4 does talk about the Prime Minister losing the confidence of a majority mm-hmm. of the members of the House.
Yeah.
Now, any budget defeat, as I mentioned earlier, must be, in my view, with an absolute majority of 112 out of 222.
That's right.
Now, what happens if there is this defeat on the budget? Must the PM resign? Juliet, I have to be very frank with you. I don't know the answer to this question because, as we said earlier, British conventions may not fully apply.
That's right.
The Prime Minister may desire to continue. What he may do is he may reintroduce the budget, renegotiate with the opposition, amend it, propose a compromise budget and say, that's what it is. I'm going to reintroduce the budget. Additionally, he may, as an interim measure, introduce a temporary supply bill under Article 102 to introduce a bill to withdraw money from the contingency fund under Article 103. There is this possibility. And you know, this will be a little bit difficult for the opposition. If the Prime Minister says, I want an interim supply bill to pay civil servants, and if opposition members shoot that down, oh my gosh.
Oh dear.
That's going to be politically very damaging. So the Prime Minister may use Article 102. But suppose he fails to get this Article 102 temporary supply bill or an urgent supply bill. Well, in which case, I think there'll be immense pressures on him to resign. And that's where the Yang Di Pertuanagong will be put in a difficult position. The Yang Di Pertuanagong wants the government to run. Yang Di Pertuanagong wants a budget to be in place. Yang Di Pertuanagong may have to ask the king to come and see him. And he may remind the Prime Minister of Article 43, Clause 4, which says, if you lose confidence, then you have only two choices, either resign or advise dissolution. So I think the king may have to take the initiative. I don't have a clear example, but I know that in Perak in 2009, Dato Sri Dr. Muhammad Nizar Jamaluddin was alleged to have lost confidence. So he was asked by the palace to resign.
Mm.
And when he refused to resign, actually, he was removed from office. So the Yang Di Pertuanagong will be put in this very difficult situation, though nowhere in the Perlembagaan does the law allow the king to dismiss a prime minister. We'll have to say, if there is such a stalemate that the budget cannot be passed and the prime minister's government is at a standstill and yet the prime minister doesn't step down, well, I think the king will have to step into the breach. And the king will have to say, you have to step down so I can form a new government that can now pilot the nation through this crisis.
Just to add, we have a very odd situation, actually, and where you have, on one hand, a lot of MPs saying that, oh, this is a government that no longer commands the confidence of the majority, yet at the same time, is able to pass by the second reading, you know.
So baffling many people today.
You could have a situation where this is a government that is not able to eventually pass the budget, but yet the prime minister would continue to command confidence of the majority. So it's a very odd situation. I can't think of any example anywhere else, or even in Malaysia, of that. So you have, and if this situation persists, you have a situation of a deadlock where the House is not able to pass the budget, and at the same time, there is a hold off as to whether or not there is confidence in the Prime Minister. And this is why I thought, as a matter of public importance, it was necessary for the motion of no confidence to be debated first in the House, so that you ascertain whether or not this is a government that has confidence of the majority. Then only, you know, you move on to the next stage of deciding whether or not that this government is able to pass a budget. But the way it's being done now, this looming question of whether or not this government has confidence of the majority, it's still very much alive. And I don't think that is helpful for the debate. I don't think it's helpful for the public in general. So I think it's a, you know, it's really a problematic situation. Of course, like what Prof Shah said earlier, by convention, he should tender a resignation. But I must say that the defeat of a supply bill, again, like what Prof Chad said, does not explicitly state that the House of Representatives has no confidence in the Prime Minister, as would be otherwise stated in a motion of no confidence.
Yes.
And just to add with on Perak, if in Perak, you can have extraneous evidence to indicate a loss of confidence, then, you know, by extension of that logic, surely evidence from the House when it comes to a defeat of a supply bill would have equal, if not greater force, to indicate loss of confidence.
Yeah.
We cannot have a situation where whatever takes place outside of the House, it's more valid than what takes place inside the House.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the principal objection that we a lot of people took in Perak, that how can you rely on extraneous evidence on the issue of confidence? Surely you must go back to the House upon which confidence resides.
That was lawyer Niu Sin Yu and Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, discussing the tabling of Budget 2021 and also walking us through some hypothetical situations had the budget been rejected. So if you'd like to hear that interview in full, just search for the podcast titled Law and Behold, Episode 34, Budget 2021. So that's it from all of us working on this series for 2020 at least. My collaborators at the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law do hope that you've enjoyed the episode so far and that you will continue to tune in and have a listen to all the 34 episodes that we've recorded to date. We've been hosting a wonderful group of lawyers and law experts since 2018 to help break down the Constitution of Malaysia. So if you're inclined to learn more, just search for Law and Behold at bfm.my or on the BFM app and just have the experts break down those complex issues for you. We'll be back in 2021. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.